I'm Jerry, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jerry.
Welcome to the Fifth Tradition Group. Oh, I mean the Primary Purpose Group. Thank you, you guys, for coming. Pierce, thanks for agreeing to speak. And actually, Pierce agreed to speak twice. We had him 2-3 weeks ago, something like that. And John Shire said, he asked him, he said, when are you speaking? He said, the date. And John said, well, that can't be right. My sponsor's speaking that date. And what happened was, I had a brain fart. I had a 58-year-old brain fart, and I booked a speaker. Completely forgot I booked the speaker. I asked all the people that booked the speakers in the group, and nobody remembered booking the speaker, so I deleted them. I put Pierce in. And then John goes, where's my sponsor? I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the guy. So we moved Pierce to today, and we were really grateful that he was able to rearrange his plans for us. You know, there's a reason why we've been asking a lot of people from Fifth to speak, because there's a lot of people over there, for starters. They always carry a strong message. I don't know Pierce real well, but everywhere I go that's a big event, I always end up running into him, and it's always a nice reunion. And I'm looking forward to hearing the story. With that, we'll give you Pierce.
My name's Pierce, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
Thanks for that kind introduction, Jerry. Happy people heard the story about a month ago. My sobriety date is June 10th, 2010, so that gives me 4 years, 1 month, and a day of sobriety. I haven't had to have a drink since the day I walked into AA. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor guys. My sponsor says he has a sponsor, but I never met him. So that's hearsay. What happened, what it was like, and what it's like now, and... I was born in the South. South Bronx. I'm the youngest of seven, very Irish Catholic family. I got four older sisters and two older brothers. And, growing up in New York City was, it was an interesting place to grow up. It's just one of those places that, you know, everyone goes thinks New York City, they think of Manhattan. Well, I grew up in the Bronx, which is basically, you know, we call Manhattan downtown. That's all we call it, you know. And people are like, what was it like growing up in the Bronx? Well, the best way to describe it is it's kind of like the Little Rascals, if anyone remembers that show, meets Goodfellas, right? You know, that's exactly what it was like. Things that I just took for granted and just assumed that's where the whole world was like. I was mistaken. I started drinking early. I was probably 10 years old, and I remember that, it was New Year's, and Brian Gaffney, he lived across the street. He was like 12, I was like 10. And our parents were having a New Year's Eve party, and they were all drinking, so we snuck away with a couple of beers, and we sucked those down. And then, that's my earliest recollection of ever drinking. And it was like, okay, this is, it tastes like shit. It was like some warm beer, like Schaefer or something like that, excuse me. It was like Schaefer beer or something, nothing spectacular. We had to use an old church key to open it. Good luck finding one of those. It's like, oh, they had them at all the parties, you know? And so that was my earliest recollection. You know, one thing I did notice is that every function we ever went to as children with my parents, there was always alcohol. This was, the 60s, it was, the swinging 60s, Mad Men, things like that. And everybody drank. And and for the longest time, I thought women did not drink beer because none of these women ever drank beer. I never saw a woman with a beer until I saw a cousin of mine's wife, and she was drinking beer. And I was like, that just kind of rocked my world. I was like, oh, I didn't think women drank beer. But that's, that's their story, not mine. Probably when I was about 12 years old was probably I'm not even sure I got drunk. It's one of those times where we had, we came across more beer, and it might have been Boone's Farm, it might have been something. I don't remember the details of it. I drank, and one thing, if you watch the way everyone drank, there was nothing, now in hindsight I think about it, there was nothing social about the way the adults drank either. It was hardcore. One drink after another, the goal was to get drunk. And growing up, you know, that was always the goal. You know, the question wasn't, are we going to go out and get some drinks or anything like that? Like, I'm talking about even, like, when we were teenagers and stuff like that. The question was, are you going to go out and get drunk tonight? Are you going to go out and get effed up tonight? You're going to, you know, and that's the way I learned to drink, was to just drink, you know, hard, fast, and there was a goal involved. There was nothing social about it. And it was sporadic drinking up until, you know, probably, you know, probably until I got out of eighth grade. Then, you know, I went to high school and drinking became more common because we were getting older and the drinking age was in New York was 18 at the time. So if you were like 16, you could go in the delicatessens and buy beer. You know, they would just sell it to you. So what happened was we had, you know, either people, you know, friends that we were hanging out with or older kids go and buy it for us. And that's when the party was on. It was, you know, we would just get cases and cases of beer. We'd get vodka. We'd get whatever we can get our hands on, you know, any booze we could, Boone's Farm, anything. And we would just drink it, you know, until people were falling down drunk. That's how we drank. We used to have drinking contests too. New York City is very ethnic, right? So it's always, you know, we hang out with a bunch of Irish people and a bunch of Italian guys, you know. So it'd always be the Irish against the Italians, and I was always the guy they put up the drink with the Irish guys, you know. And we always won. You know, to this day they're still talking about me and Tommy McMahon, you know. And it was an interesting, you know, of course, you know, I wasn't that old, so I didn't have consequences then. But one thing I did have was I had feelings. I had feelings of, you know, that I realized that my how I felt about myself and everything around me changed when I drank. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't, you know, being the youngest of seven, there's sometimes a problem to that, is you're always somebody's younger brother, but in school it was always like, well, you know, you're definitely not, you're like your sister, or you're definitely not your brother. You know, I was, you know, a straight C&D student, and I was pretty damn proud of that, and, you know, they always said I had, you know, anything I did basically was I did it where I was always a contender, but never enough. Does anyone understand that? Basically was, you know, like I was on the track team, and I wasn't the fastest, but they said I had great stamina. You know, and all through that my life, that has done me well, having great stamina. That's how you end up drinking for 40 years, you know. Needless to say, you know, those were just some of the instances. You know, some of the consequences when I was younger, there really wasn't any, as I said, you know. But I did strange things. Like one time when I was about 10 years old, we were down in Florida. We took, you know, and it was Easter time, and there was a paddle boat, and I wanted to go on the paddle boat. My parents wouldn't let me, so that night I stole $10, and I rented the paddle boat. The only problem is that when you're one person on a paddle boat, you get yourself out there, then you're tired of coming back, right? But that's what I'm talking about. I would do things like that. I would do what I wanted when I wanted it. I didn't care what the consequences were going to be, and trust me, I got my ass kicked over that. You know, they figured out I stole the money, and blah, 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 and it was just, you know. But that was me, you know, taking my will and doing what I wanted to do. You know, I'm there with my brothers and sisters, and that's, you know, they didn't feel like they had to go on the paddle boat. I did. And you know, drinking was what everyone did for social activity. There was no organized sports. You went to a high school dance. They had high school dances, and at one of my high school dances, a little band called Twisted Sister was the neighborhood man. They played at it. But that was just it. And the only way anyone had any courage was liquid courage. You drank before you went in, and the priests and the nuns were like, come here, you know, and they talk real low, so you had to get close to them so they could smell your breath, right? This way they knew if you were smoking or drinking. And so, you know, so you learned basically was to get in like when the parent chaperone was at the door. You know, they weren't so concerned about it. You know, my mother, my father were both heavy drinkers. My mother was a raging alcoholic. She would go on benders for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time. As a child, you know, my older brother, between me and my older sister, there's 13 years. So when I was 6 years old, she was already 20. And, you know, and it went from there. So they were off in college and things like that. One of the things, you know, my father, because he had a job, he worked for the city, and he could go, you know, he was chief of police in New York City, so he can go to any precinct he wanted to and work out of that. And what he did was, you know, I remember me and my younger sister It's two of them, Keelan and Karen. They, you know, he, you know, we weren't in school yet, and my mother would be on a bender, and they would put us in the basement, and we'd be down there watching TV, doing whatever. And there was a hook lock on the door, and that's how he'd keep us down there. And you know, he'd come in periodically and check on us. And so, you know, so that's, you know, in my mind's eye, that is what an alcoholic is. It was my mother. You know, basically, you drank in the bedroom, you drank, you know. I can't remember ever going to a family function where we didn't have to carry her out of. That was my definition of an alcoholic, you know. And then my father, you know, he was an alcoholic also, you know, like, you know, but if you use that as a definition, anyone seems normal compared to that. You know, things like, you know, you get up, and one thing we were taught was never touch the gun. No matter where the gun is, never touch the gun. So you'd wake up in the morning, my father would be passed out on the kitchen floor, and the gun would be in the middle of the floor. So you step over him, and you step over the gun. You know, it was, and that was, you know, just the, you know, the everyday life that I had. You know, it was the deep, dark family secret. You know, and that's where I learned the whole thing is basically, you don't share your secrets. Where this is our problem, we'll deal with it. I ran my whole life, this is my problem, I'll deal with it. Never knowing how to ask for help, never knowing who to ask. No matter how bad it got, I'll get myself out of this. And you know, and that didn't serve me well in a lot of parts of my life because I lived, you know, a lot of that with, you know, that mentality most of my life. So when I was 11 years old, I went to school one Wednesday and I came home and there was police cars all up and down the street. May Gaffney, the next door neighbor, is looking out the front door and I go walking down the street. It's like, what the hell's going on here? And then she closed the door, so I walked around the back of the house and I go in and my father was dead. He died, he was 54 years old, died of a heart attack. So I was 11 years old and, you know, I don't even know how I felt. I don't even know if I ever grieved that loss. You know, that I don't know. Basically, at that point, I was already good at stuffing my feelings because of just, you know, the environment I was in, you know, between my mother's drinking and being the youngest of seven has some mental conditions to it, too. You know, whether I did it or not, I got blamed for it. So, but these are just, you know, some of the things that make me the person that is standing in front of you today, how I ended up getting here. And then when I was 17, you know, my mother basically, you know, she died the day my father did, except she killed herself with alcohol. And it took 6 years later, she drank herself to death. She died in my arms on New Year's Eve, 1979. I was 17. After that, you know, and in the meantime, like my drinking with my friends was escalating. You know, I didn't, you know, and I was thinking about it before I came here. You know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't always, you know, have to have a drink. I know that because there's times in my life where I went long periods of time without drinking. And so it was, you know, I was, you know, more of the, you know, I went through more of the stages of alcoholism, like they talk about in the book. You know, at one time I might, you know, I was a heavy drinker, then I became a problem drinker, and now, you know, then I somewhere I crossed the line. I don't know what day it was. I can't tell you when it happened, but it did. I remember when I was in college in California, I would drink one day a week. I'd go out and get a six pack of Tall Boys. And that was my treat, and you know, so you know, it was one of those deals. It was, you know, it wasn't always as crazy, you know, as crazy. It was crazy, but it, you know, and trust me, there were areas of craziness in that time, where you know the consequences were starting to build up. When I was 19 years old, I got a DUI. That was the first consequence I ever had. I didn't go to court on it. I figured, you know, once again, basically the law doesn't apply to me, and I lived most of my life that way. With basically not having to follow rules, as those are their rules, you know, I'm not going to go to court. Turns out one of my friends worked at the courthouse, and she told me there was a warrant out for my arrest, and she also told my brother, and he made me go to court. When I was 21, I was sitting in a bar in the Bronx in New York, and there was Fitzy sitting next to me, John Fitzpatrick, and then two stools down was John Fitzpatrick, his father, and then two stools down was John Fitzpatrick Sr. And I'm sitting there, you know, and these guys, you know, this is an old neighborhood bar, you know, and smoking cigarettes and drinking beer. And, you know, I just looked at those guys and I said, you know, you guys are, you know, I said something and they're like, ah, Pierce, you're never going to leave. You're stuck here like the rest of us. The next day I got in my car and I drove to California. First geographical cure. Didn't know a soul. Didn't know anybody in California when I got there. Just drove. And, you know, I got to Sacramento, and I said, you know, this is not the California I know from the movies. You know, I went down to so I got on the highway and drove down to San Diego, got to the Mexican border, and said, well, I don't speak Spanish, so I hung out in San Diego for a year, and I really started heavy partying when I was in San Diego. I was free of any bondage that I had on the East Coast. I could be anybody I wanted to be. Nobody knew me. And in some ways, that's pretty freeing. You know, you're nobody's little brother. You don't have the embarrassments of your parents. You don't have this, you don't have that. And, you know, so I ended up, you know, living in San Diego for about a year. I was working down there, and I ended up, just finding people that drank the way I wanted to drink. Then, you know, life was crazy, my life was very simple. There was no obligations. I wasn't responsible to anybody. Nobody really cared. You know, it was a very transient lifestyle. That's what it was. It was very transient. People would come, people would go. Nobody cared. And but the thing was that I was the ugly New Yorker. You know, I compared everything to New York City. You know, how come I can't get, you know, Indian food at 3 o'clock in the morning delivered to me? That was a problem, you know, right? Not that I wanted Indian food, but right? But if I wanted to have it, I wanted to have it. And I met people down there that were from all over the country. I was like, okay, well, everyone seems, you know, to be the same all over the country, because these people were all drinking the way I drank, which was hard and with a purpose by this point. It was basically was to get drunk, get, you know, just wrecked. Blackout was you know, part of the program. You know, if you weren't blacking out, geez, I didn't get my money's worth. So then one day I decided that I had it with these people, and I moved to, because San Diego was too small of a town. That's what it was. So I ended up moving up to LA, and that's where craziness really started. It was, you know, I was, you know, I was working and I was not working, and I'd have a place to live. I wouldn't have a place to live. You know, so basically all the trappings. But I was young. I was like 23 years old. I'm like, well, hell, I can go live on the beach. That's okay. And so I never considered myself, you know, homeless, right? But it was my lifestyle choices that got me there. You know, this is when I started getting more involved in outside issues. So I'd get paid on Friday, but Monday I'd be broke. And, you know, every penny I had was gone. And, but I still figured out how to drink. Even though I didn't have any money, it's amazing how we can do that. We can figure out how to drink every whenever we want when we don't have money. And so I ended up, you know, living there for about 4 years. And then, one day my sister, she lived in Colorado, and she called me up. She said, why don't you come up for Thanksgiving? This was 1986, 87, somewhere around there. And I ended up going out there, and I stayed for 20 years. And that's, yeah. Not at her house. a story of that, about the book talks about it, is getting tied at all the wrong times. My sister in 1992 was getting married, and so what happened was, I was going to give her away. So all my family flew in for this big East Coast type wedding in Colorado. The night before the wedding, what happens? Pierce gets arrested for DUI, and it wasn't his first one, and they didn't want to let him out of jail, right? So what happened was my brothers and sisters, I've got attorneys in my family of the yin yang. They went and they figured it out and got me out of there. And, you know, but that's just talk about getting tight at all the wrong times. You know, I got like the one thing I've been responsible for, in my 20s at the time, you know, my late 20s. The one thing in my life I really had to be responsible for, and what do? I go out and get drunk and get arrested. And, you know, I ended up getting quite a few DUIs in Colorado. And, you know, the funny thing was they never sent me to AA. They sent me to everything but AA. They sent me to education. They sent me to jail. They sent me to home detention. They sent me to breathalyzers. But they never sentenced me to AA. And, you know, and it was funny because I had a probation officer, and she was in AA, and she's tried talking to me about it. And I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I don't have a drinking problem. But that's where my mindset was. and that was just it was, you know, and the way I looked at it, and this is how selfish I was, in hindsight, I can see it. The laws did not apply to me, right? They took my license. I didn't care. I still drove, right? what does anyone care if I'm drinking and driving? I'm not hurting anybody. That's the way I thought was, you know, I was totally clueless about thinking about any of these people. And so I was very selfish. I was, you know, the selfishness was unbelievable. That's one thing I've realized in this program is how selfish I really am. It never dawned on me how selfish I was. And this went on for years, you know. So finally, 8 years ago this December, I made the big move to Atlanta. The last geographical cure. I came down here. This woman was going to save me. Well, guess what? I didn't last very long, right? Because, see, we dated on and off for a lot of years. And whenever she saw me, she thought we were having a good weekend, you know? To me, that was just normal. So what happened was I ended up moving into her house. Everything was hers. And I still have a little bit of bitterness there I need to work through. But what happened was one day she said to me, she said, can you not work for, you know, just not drink for a week? And that didn't work out very well because I came home one night and all my shit was packed. You know, that was somebody who actually kept their word on basically was, I'm going to throw you out. And she did. And so what I do is what any good alcoholic does is I go find the nearest hotel and then I go live in there for a month, the Holiday Inn on La Vista. And, you know, the liquor store was right next door, so that worked out really well. So then I could drink the way I wanted to drink. Now I didn't have the burden of her, basically, you know, concerned about my drinking, talking about my drinking, telling me that you can't drink this way. And so I drank for, you know, this was, what, in 2007. So in 2009, I was out at a company function, and I'm driving home. I was driving home from the company function. I got a DUI here in Atlanta. So what happens is, right, this is like my seventh, eighth DUI. I don't know. So I'm thinking, oh, shit, I'm going to prison. That's what I'm thinking. And everyone's like, oh, you got to get a lawyer. You got to do this. You got to do that. And you know, it's funny because whenever I've gotten a lawyer, I usually get them in hindsight because I already negotiated a better deal than I think they can, right? And I bring them in to cover my butt. That's anytime I'm in trouble, that's what I've done. I run them in after the fact. And so what happens is, well, here goes the thing, right? I got arrested. I was at Marlo's at the DoubleTree Hotel. It was a company function, and I lived like a mile away from there. And somehow I got arrested up on North Druid Hills and Claremont. Don't ask me what I was doing down there. I was in a blackout. I have no idea how I got there. It was just one of those things. Of course, being the good alcoholic I was, right? The ignition in my car was broken, so I always had to park on a hill. And so I popped the clutch to get the car started. And because I don't have time to get these things fixed, that's just a minor inconvenience, right? Right? So I don't know, somehow I think that had something to do with it, how I ended up in Claremont about 6 miles from my house. And it was funny because I was driving on that road last night going down to meet Daryl, or he was following me, and I'm on this road and I'm saying, damn, this is a windy road, because I got on at just about the same point and I didn't even go as far. I'm like, how the heck did I drive at that time? What I did. So needless to say, was I ended up in jail, right? So they're not letting me out. They're not letting me out of jail. So I have to call, right? So I call work. I figure, well, they'll get me out. Well, nobody there wanted to get me out. I don't know why, but they wanted, right? So they ended up calling my sister in Colorado, who happened to call my brother, who actually comes down here quarterly because he's on the board of directors of a company down here. And he was down here, and he got me out. So, you know, something I was trying to do is basically, here it is, Pierce is messing up again, getting in more trouble, and once again, my family's got to come and get my butt out. And so I ended up going to court, and, you know, so I'm like, you know, people are telling me, you know, it's like, oh, you need to get a lawyer. And I'm like, you know, let me see what I can do. So you go into court, and they say to you, do you want to plead guilty, not guilty, or do you want to talk to the solicitor? So I said, well, I got nothing to lose by talking to the solicitor. So I talked to the solicitor. So they opened it up and they said, well, your BAC was kind of high. That was 3.1 or 0.031. And, but they said, but, you know, it's your first offense, right? I said, what do I sign? So that was my experience with my DUI in Atlanta. But yeah, you know, that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I honestly thought I was going to prison over it. I really did. I was like, you know, and I don't know how they didn't find the other ones. I don't know, but they just didn't. And I just said, you know. So needless to say, I still drank for another while. But what happened was, I was a jerk at work. We got this new executive vice president, and he came from a different industry. We used to have these trainings, and they put us in a training room that was about half the size of this room, and they had like 30 people in there. And, the vendors would come in and they would train us. And then, so finally one day I'm walking out of there, I'm hungover. Every day I was hungover. It was, and I just looked at the executive vice president and I said, I don't have time to put up your learning curve. Because he came from a different industry and, he'd ask these ridiculous questions. I said, if you want to talk to the vendors about that, you need to go outside and talk to them about that because I don't have time to put up with it. And I walked away. Well, then, about a month later, I called in sick for a month because I was so, resentful. I got drunk for all month, the month of March of 2010. It worked out well because I got acid reflux so bad that I ended up, I couldn't swallow anymore. It burnt my throat so much and I couldn't swallow. And if you can't swallow, you can't breathe because you can't clear your lungs. So I ended up going to the hospital. And so I go in the hospital and I get into the ER and they end up taking a throat x-ray, right? And so I'm in there and, the next thing I know, they're bringing all these carts in. I'm like, what the hell's going on, And they're like, well, we think you have throat cancer. I was like, oh, shit. So I laid there for like 2 hours thinking I'm going to die, right? Right? Poor me, So I ended up, so then all of a sudden they came in, they took all the carts out, and I'm like, what the hell's going on? Oh, they sent your x-ray off to somebody else, and they said, you got acid reflux. And they get, so they gave me this stuff that would allow me to I think it's called green goo or something like that. Amy, you probably know better than I do. It's something, basically, it's got morphine in it, it relaxes your whole throat and everything else like that. So finally, I could swallow and I could breathe again, right? So, it wasn't long again, I was drinking again. And, So this brings me, what happened was, my numbers ended up crashing in April. They ended up firing me, right? Well, now basically it was, I was just on a tear. And I was in such despair because I've been drinking now for really hard for the last 3 or 4 years. Just basically the way my day looked was I would go to work. I would swear I wasn't going to drink. Then about 3 o'clock, I'm like, I'm starting to feel better. And then next thing I know, 6 o'clock, I'm in the liquor store. And then, drinking to oblivion and then getting up in the morning, next morning and doing the same thing. I don't think I had a sober breath in that whole time because your body just can't process that much alcohol that quickly. And that was the mental obsession of it and the physical allergy kicking in. Once I was drinking, I couldn't stop drinking. And once I drank, I couldn't. And once I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And the book talks about that, where basically is, and that was the point that I was at. I got to the point where, I was in bed, I was drinking 24/7, wasn't getting up. The only time I'd go is I'd go to the liquor store, get more booze, get some cigarettes, and just didn't shower, didn't do anything, just drank. And then, I called my sister and I told her I was going to kill myself. Well, that was a mistake. She took me serious. I told her, I said, Karen, I said, I'm turning into mom. And she knew what I meant by that. I was turning into my mother, basically just laying in bed drinking. That's what I was doing. And I told her I was going to kill myself. And the next thing I know, I got the CAP fire department in my house. I got the Georgia crisis line calling me. It wasn't a pretty picture. So she started calling around. She found a treatment center. She knew where I lived. I was living in Tucker at the time. And they asked if I was still drunk. And she said yes. I said, well, we can't take you. He's got to go to Peachford Hospital. That's how I ended up at Peachford. I knew nothing about it. I ended up going there. I was there for 5 days or 6 days, I forget. And they're like, well, we're going to let you go. I was like, no. Because when I got there, when they checked me in, I was still blew something ridiculous. I don't know, 2.8, 2.9, something like that. And I started detoxing while I was in intake. And, and it started coming on then really quickly. And then I, they gave me Valium and they had me on, they chemically detoxed me. That's what I needed. I needed to be chemically detoxed because, the book talks about that some of us need to go to hospitals. Now, that's not everyone's story. That was my story. And it worked out well. So I ended up going through through their IOP program, their PHP. Basically, it reminded me a lot of the education I took when I was doing my DUI classes. This is Pierce's body. This is what happens when you drink. This is your liver. These things just are You know, and that's, you know, and in hindsight, I know the term for it. It's fraught emotional appeal. You know, my liver could be hanging out my side, and if I want to drink, I'm still going to drink. You know, but one thing they did was I went to AA meetings there. I don't remember the AA meetings while I was there. I slept through most of them. I slept through most AA meetings the first 3 months I was sober. I could not stay awake. I was that exhausted. You know, some of these people in this room remember that. You know, my sponsor always talks about that. I used to sleep in the business meetings too. But what happened was one of the things so I went to a treatment center, and one of the things was I had to get a sponsor. So I heard this man telling his story, and he was nothing like me. He was a doctor at one time, and you know I was never going to be a doctor. You know, he was in sobriety. He lost a child, and I'm thinking, how the hell, you know, that's got to be the most painful thing you can think of, is that losing a child. And so I asked him to be my sponsor, and we worked closely together for about 3 or 4 months, and he had me up to the fourth step, and then his life situation changed, and he told me that he could no longer be my sponsor. He was leaving, moving to a different place. And at the same point, I was leaving the treatment center. I was I had a choice to make there. Basically, I was feeling better. My life was getting better, you know. The choice that I had was, do I keep doing what I was doing, or do I go back to what I was doing? Because I didn't have a sponsor. I was leaving the treatment center, so I had no one to really answer to. And I chose to keep doing what I was doing. And the following night or a couple of days later, I asked another man in that group to be my sponsor. And he agreed to it, and we finished going through the steps. What happened? How do you describe a miracle? You know, I don't know. I really, every fiber of my being was craving alcohol for a long time, and I didn't even realize it. And then, I started doing what everyone around me was doing. I joined a home group. I got a sponsor. We were working the steps. I got through the steps. I'm still working on my 9-step amends. You know, I have one that's been hanging over my head now for the last 15 years. It's called the IRS, but I'm plowing through that too. I got involved. That was probably the biggest thing I could say that I did, was I got involved. You know, and I think this is a pretty committed group here. If you're here on a Friday night at 9 o'clock for a meeting, you know, you're probably involved. I did what I was told, you know, and that's, you know, and in some ways that I blame that on the nuns and my parents, because I learned to do what I was told very young, and I did what I was, you know, and nothing was a suggestion. I didn't think anything was optional. It's like, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it 100%. I'm not here. You know, like when I was in the treatment center, there were people that were paying, that their parents were paying, and they were there for every other reason. I was writing that check every month. And by writing that check every month, I had the skin in the game. And if I, you know, because I could have left it at any time. And I did the same thing with AA. It was, I'm going to put some skin in this game, and because I can leave at any time. I can go drink tomorrow. But if I'm going to be here, I'm going to do what other people have done that it has proven successful. I'm very good at visualization. You know, don't tell me, you know, show me what you've done, and I can copy it very well. And by doing all these things, getting a sponsor, doing service work, going through the 12 steps, working the 12 steps, carrying these principles into my life on a daily basis, and that's what I do. I really try to carry this in my life on a daily basis. You know, people talk about, oh, well, I still get upset about traffic. The only time I'm upset about traffic is it means I left early, which goes back to a character defect. I left late, which goes back to a character defect. Basically, I'm not planning well. And, you know, and that's on me again. I have a lot of friends in AA. Most of my friends are in AA. Everyone, you know, I talk to alcoholics every single day. I look around this room, I see a lot of people I know. It's a good feeling. I want to talk about, you know, how I've changed. And how I've changed is I was always good at basically putting up walls and masking what's going on in my life. Having a wall around me meant that you couldn't touch me, you couldn't hurt me. And I still work on trying to lower those boundaries because sometimes I can be very aloof, very distant, very cold, very hard on people because I'm, you know. And that's, you know, that's one of the things I've done very well in my life is put people at a distance, is you're good about here. Don't try to get here because you're not going to get here. And, you know, sharing what I'm feeling is difficult for me. Honesty was never a hard thing for me. But sharing, you know, what's really going on with me, which is, you know, probably another form of lying, right? Basically being dishonest I try to be more, you know, I don't even know the words I'm trying to look for. I think if a more spiritual person is not the guy that's gonna, he died and so what or whatever, there's gonna be some pain there or something. And you know, there's been a few times that things have happened, like today, here's an example. My brother calls me up, and one of my cousins, he was having a baby on July 8th, and the baby was full term, and the baby died. And, I don't know if I was supposed to feel what I was supposed to feel, but I really didn't feel anything. And that's one of the things that, you know, I really, you know, is you know, I don't know what to feel. And that's what I'm realizing is that, you know, I shut my feelings down for so many decades that to have a true feeling in a lot of ways is very hard. And those are, you know, something that, you know, I pray about. I pray, you know, allow me to have compassion. I've been praying for that probably since year two, right? And it's, you know, and some days I think I have it, and other days it's like, you have no compassion at all for anybody but yourself. And that's the selfishness in me, is the only person I care about is me. And, you know, those are just, you know, some of the things that I need to work on today is, you know, alcohol is no longer a problem. You know, I don't think about it. I'm not that far away. You know, basically I know that if I don't do what I need to do on every day on a spiritual basis, that I will drink, and I know I will. It's not an if, it's a will. I don't know what day it's going to be, but it's going to be one day. You know, with the things in my life that are going on, I have a pretty damn good life these days. I've got good friends, right? You know, I was out eating with them. See, another thing was, if you see the spot on my tie here? See, this would have really bothered me a couple of years ago, right? But I was out eating with two of my buddies back there, Daryl and Trey, and we got this big thing of potato chips with blue cheese on it. I take the first one. What does it do? Right down my tie. That would have driven me nuts. I wouldn't have been able to do this. I wouldn't have been, I'd be like, oh God, they're all going to be looking at my tie and I don't look complete and blah, 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 blah. You know, if that's the biggest problem I got in my life today, I'm doing okay. You know? And, I've had challenges in sobriety, employment challenges. Some of those are somewhere along the way I ended up picking up a felony about 25 years ago. And, you know, now they seem to want to do background checks on everybody. And just twice I was at the job, and you know, one time I was actually hired. I was on the job 2 days, and they came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, oh, we got to withdraw your offer. And then another time I was a temp for 6 months, I got the job, and I was down in New Orleans at the Jazz Festival with two guys in the back there, and I get a call, right? And because what happened was, when I was leaving, I went to my boss and I said, listen, I said, you know, I said, I've been here 6 months, I've done everything you asked me to do, you know, I'd really like to get hired. And I you know, they knew about my record when I was a temp, but then they went to go hire me perm time, they kicked it up legal thing, it's like, we can't hire this guy. And, you know, those were big challenges, you know. And so what happened was, I was down at the New Orleans Jazz Festival, and I get a phone call, and I come back and I talk to these guys, and like, you're not gonna believe this, I got fired from my job. I'm like, I'm the only guy I know that can get fired on vacation. Since then, things have turned around. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Ironically, the same boss that wanted to hire me, that HR wouldn't hire me, he is my boss now at a different company. He knows all about my skeletons in my closet. He knows I'm in the program. You know, it's amazing what when you're honest to people, you know, about what's going on, that they can overlook. You know, forgiveness is something that just amazes me. People, you know, I don't know if I was in the same situation, would I take a risk on a person like me? You know? And I hope I would, I really do. But I, you know, right now I can't say whether I would or I wouldn't. You know, I you know, just a lot of miracles have happened, you know, and the biggest one is that I get to stand up here and talk to you guys, and you know, that somebody actually wants to hear my story. With that, I'm going to thank you all, and I think I'm about out of time on my tour.